Okay, so welcome to another episode of Garden State Coachcast. I'm your host, Mick Hughes, and it's my pleasure to have with me today Jay Graber, the head coach at Matawan High School, the newly minted head coach over there. Also, another neighbor. You're my second neighbor on the podcast. So, Jay, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Sounds good. So Jay, let's just talk about, we'll start with your background, where you played, who you played for, how did your experience as a player inform you as a coach, and we can go from there.
Yeah, sure. So I grew up in Millstone, which is, sending district to Allentown High School, where I originally coached. Grew up playing all types of different sports. You know, we were sports people growing up, baseball, football, basketball, tennis, soccer, you name it. We played it. My parents were very big on get out of the house, go play, you know, things like that. I went to Notre Dame High School, played three sports there, baseball, football, and basketball. From there, moved on to Hofstra University, and then eventually transferred to Bryan University, played football there. So had a lot of different experiences, been around, really love sports and being around all the different sports. So,
well, that's interesting, right? Because now we're in an age where everybody wants to specialize. And so you having played all of those different sports, how do you think does that play a role in your approach as a coach at all? Do you think it benefits these kids to play multiple sports? Do you think they should specialize? Where do you fall on that one?
Sure. That's a great question and, you know, a hot button topic right away for high school coaches, you know, with the specialization, with the travel teams, the AAU, you have all of these different people in these kids' ears about, you know, if you focus on one thing, you can get a scholarship. They, you know, propose that there's a lot of money out there, all of those different items that give young kids that really aren't ready to make those types of decisions. You know, it gives them things to think about that they really shouldn't be thinking about at this age. You know, they're young. They don't know what they want or how they want it just yet. You know, so we should give them an opportunity to play multiple sports, to compete on different levels as much as we possibly can. I mean, personally, I tell all my kids to go out and play sports, go out and play as much as you can, go out and compete. You know, we will never be able to simulate what it is to compete, you know, go out there and play baseball, football, basketball, compete for 10 months of the year. And then in the summer, we have our summer programs. You go play, you know, your summer games and things like that. But I'm a huge proponent of no specialization, have kids go out and play different sports, have different experiences, enjoy their time. I mean, when I was in high school, I thought that I was going to be a baseball player because I was a lefty pitcher. You know, I loved basketball the most, playing basketball, you know, so I played basketball through high school and I wanted to play in college, but I wasn't good enough. You know, I didn't know that until I experienced the fact that I wasn't good enough and ended up playing football in college. So, you know, if I would have put all my eggs in the basketball basket, I wouldn't have been in college where I was. And, you know, it's like the same thing with my major personally. I started off as an engineering major and then I got a finance degree and now I'm a special ed math teacher and a coach, right? So, you know, you don't know what you want, how you want it. So for us as coaches, as mentors, as parents, as people that are influential in the lives of kids, for us to tell a kid, you know, oh, focus on one sport, focus on one thing, I just don't think that that's right because you never know how good you're going to be at different sports and different, you know, different talents. So that's my opinion on that. And I'm very strong with that. So.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, a lot of kids are like, oh, you know, I'm going to not play basketball because I'm going to lift. And okay. But interestingly, a couple of years ago, I had a kid who he's a really good lacrosse player. He ended up leading the state in goals, kid by the name of Kyle Prouty, and he decided to come out and play basketball his senior year. He was going to Johns Hopkins, so, you know, great lacrosse program, and his coach explicitly told him, yeah, go play basketball. Like, I want you to do that, and I think that kind of goes along with what you're saying. Probably the coach was like, well, you're going to be in good shape. You're going to be competing on a daily basis. You know, you're going to have to be somewhere every day, and so – It's interesting. He wasn't like, no, I need you to be stronger, go in the weight room. It was interesting that a guy at that level of a high level of a Division I sport was encouraging him not to be specialized. Let's go back a little bit to high school. How do you think the landscape has changed since you've been in high school? Outside of the specialization, do you see any other things that have really, you know, took a turn one way or another?
Sure. So, you know, being involved in so many different sports, playing and coaching, you know, I've seen a lot of change, some for the better and some not for the better. To football specifically, just some of the rules have changed with the safety of the game, which I definitely agree with. I think that we have a lot more technology and information at our fingertips, and we should utilize it. You know, I think that if we can make rule changes and tweaks to improve the game, we should. You know, so I think that we're doing a good job with that. So in terms of the change, I see that. But with the other sports, what I'm seeing is, you know, since football, there is no AAU, there is no travel, there's no off-season football teams to play on. You know, the high school team is really the focal point. Mm-hmm. So it's still the focal point of the school, and it brings about a lot of camaraderie and things like that. You know, coaching basketball too, as you do, right. And, you know, baseball and lacrosse and those sports, we get into a situation where our kids are playing in the summer and they're playing AAU and they're playing travel. And, you know, brutal honesty is – college basketball coaches can't recruit kids during our time, right? During mm-hmm. our high school season.
Yeah.
So the kids have a little bit more of a focus on the AAU and the travel and things like that. And that happens in soccer, lacrosse, every sport. So I just see a little bit of a change in terms of what the kids think is important. I wish that kids would value their high school team a lot more than they do at times. But again, I think that that goes back to what parents and what AAU coaches and travel coaches are saying to these kids that, you know, listen, if you pay a lot of money, you give me a lot of money to play for my AAU team, I'm going to get you a scholarship somewhere, you right. know? And I don't necessarily think that I don't think that there's a lot of morals being followed with some of it. As, you know, because everybody needs to pay a mortgage. Everybody has mm-hmm. a paycheck. And in some cases, like running an AAU program is their paycheck. So, you know, just as educators, you're an educator for a long time. So am mm-hmm. I. You know, we're teachers as well. We're teachers first and then coaches. You know, we see what's best for the kid inside and out. And some of these programs, I think, don't always do that. Not to knock on them.
Right.
You know, because you could be an AAU coach, you know.
Right.
But I just think that a little bit of the change is that when I was growing up, you know, playing for the high school team was the premier thing to do.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't right. AAU and travel. It was playing for the high school team. So I think that some of that has shifted. So that's been, you know, a little bit of what I've seen change in high school.
Yeah. And then, you know, you see all the transfers that go on now and everything. And so that loyalty to, you know, your high school or where you grew up or where you started high school, that changes. And then, you know, they're just loyalty. That's something that I think is kind of gone by the wayside a little bit. Let's shift gears a little bit. Let's talk about what was your first coaching job and how you got into it and everything.
Sure. So I ended up getting a finance degree from Bryant University. My older sister was in accounting at the time. She played basketball at LaSalle University. She got a job in Philly, a great business job. I wasn't really sure that I wanted to live that lifestyle just yet, that I wanted to wake up at 6 a.m. and pound the pavement with a shirt and tie and all that stuff. You know, I'm a real big sports person. So I didn't, you know if I wanted to get out of the game yet and everything. So in the summer, after I had, you know, gone through a couple tryouts and not made it to where I wanted to in football, I got a call from somebody from Allentown High School about their freshman football vacancy. So, you know, I jumped at the opportunity. It was something that would, you know, give me the opportunity to see if this was something I really wanted to do, you know. So that was my first job as the freshman football coach at Allentown. And with a finance degree, I had to go back to school for a while to get math and then eventually special ed. So that was my first job. It was a fantastic opportunity. And excuse me, after the season, we had a good season. We had a strong season. The head varsity coach at Allentown had resigned. And so I applied for the job, didn't think that I was going to get it. And that led me to getting the job at Allentown as the head varsity coach.
How old were you?
25. I was 1 month into my 25th birthday. Ooh, yeah. I was not ready for it. I was not ready at all for it.
Yeah.
You know, I had a coach that I played for in high school, Chappie Moore, you know, and
at when Notre Dame.
Right? Yeah. Notre okay. Dame. Yeah. And when you're young, right. I mean, you know, this, I'm older and I still do this, you know, we ask for advice, right? And we want to try to be a sponge, you know, to be as good a coach as we can, as good a teacher as we can. And I'll never forget, he told me, he said, through the interview process, because the interview process was extensive. There was like 16 people on the panel. It was three rounds. It was very extensive. 2 hour interviews. You know, they really peeled the onion, you know, for right. all of us. So.
Right. At 25, that's daunting. Let's just pause and talk about that for a second. What did you go in with preparation wise? Did you show up like, do you have like a playbook? What did you write an essay? I don't even know. What did you even do?
No, I mean, I had my portfolio with my cover letter and resume, had had a, you know, a portion of the portfolio had to do with getting the community involved, getting the youth programs involved, mm-hmm. What we were going to do to build the program, because Allentown High School at the time was one of the worst football programs in the state.
Yeah.
You know, 43 straight losing seasons. You had 30 game losing streaks. It was a difficult task, and a lot of the kids weren't going there. I mean, I grew up in Allentown and I didn't go there. I went to Notre Dame, you know, so, and it wasn't even a thought to go there because they hadn't taken sports serious. And, you know, I was a good student, but sports is very important to me and my family, you know, So just went in with a plan, very confident about the plan based on what I did in high school and some different things that I learned, again, you know, talking to different coaches and things. And, you know, we were able to make it work. The superintendent at the time, Dr. Fitzpatrick, really believed in me when I don't know that the panel did.
Right.
But he did. And that was it. So my high school coach said to me that the interview would be the easiest part. And then once you get the job, then the hard part starts, you know?
Right.
And I thought the interview was like incredibly hard, right? Because it was three rounds in 2 hours. So yeah, so it was a different experience.
Do you remember where you were when you got the call to say, hey, Jay, we want you to be the coach? Do you remember that day at all or no?
Sure. So I got a call from the superintendent that he wanted to meet with me for the final round.
Okay.
So he hadn't offered me the job yet.
Right.
And this was about my final round interview was about 3 weeks before the board meeting. And we met, and it was down to me and one other person. So there were two of us left. And the superintendent didn't have any plans on offering the job, you know, because they had 3 weeks till the board meeting, but we sat and we met for like 3 or 4 hours. And, you know, the superintendent is a very kind, gentle guy. He has 8 kids, 19 grandkids, you know, so we got talking.
Wow.
And it was, So we got talking. And then by the end of the interview and the end of the conversation, he was like, look, like, I'm going to offer you the job, but not going to announce it for 3 weeks till the board meeting. So kind of a rite of passage here is you can't tell anybody that I'm going to offer you the job. There's going to be a lot of talk around town. There's going to be a lot of things said. Right. You know, this is a pretty prominent position. It's a head football job.
Yeah, yeah.
So I said, okay. I said, no problem. I won't tell anybody. And I didn't. So for 3 weeks, everybody thought it was going to be a different guy. And
yeah.
When it was announced, you know, he called me and he said, congratulations, you were approved. And you know, now I know that I can trust you because for 3 weeks, nobody said a word about you.
Yeah.
You know?
Uh-huh.
So it was good. So it was a good situation to walk into at such a young age and it being a first head coaching job. So.
Yeah. It's just, it's funny because, you know, we're going off a kind of a a shell of questions that I've been asking most of the coaches come on, but that's something that I think is interesting is, you know, the interview process as a young kid going into, and that they put you through the ringer there. And I think that that's something that, you know, you go into with the fundamentals, like, okay, I'm going to wear a tie. I'm going to write my philosophy out. I'm going to have, you know, when you get older, you compile like a playbook and stuff like that. But I, you know, going through that at that age, that's crazy. How did it build from there? So, because, you know, you guys really built Allentown into, you know, a perennial contender. You won a state title. You went to a state final. Am I right with that?
Yeah.
So talk about the maybe process from going from that, you know, 25-year-old kid to the point where you're contending every year and all that.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, I think the first thing that we focused on is building a relationship with kids, because as you get into education, you learn that kids want that discipline. You know, they want to be challenged. They want to reach their potential.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it just takes a little bit more, right? We have to pry it out of them. And, you know, sometimes we have to be difficult. Sometimes we have to give them challenges that they're not going to conquer right away.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I think that the first part of what we did as a coaching staff was really build relationships with those kids, you know, and as we did that, and as we were able to put a program together, the kids started to believe, they started to trust the coaches, and they started to believe in what we were doing and how we were doing it in terms of, and, you know, again, football is just the one season. You don't have AAU or travel or anything. So a big determinant of football is the off season, right? Where you're lifting and you're running and you're not doing anything with football. So, you know, when we got the job in February, we started with the lifting program and the running and, you know, taking care of our business in the classroom. You know, we had a couple kids acting up in class and we addressed that right away. You know, we created a discipline within the program.
So talk about that a little bit, because I think that that's something that I think everybody can learn from a little bit, is especially football, you're dealing with how many guys on a roster?
At any given time, there's a lot.
Yeah,
up to 100. You know,
so
it's a lot. So,
you know, okay. So guys are acting up. What kinds of things do you think are effective to reduce that or eliminate it altogether? And, you know, go ahead and talk about that a little bit.
Sure. So a lot of what we talk about in our program is building the whole student athlete, building the whole person, not just a football player, not just a basketball player, not just a student. You know, building the person as a whole. So a lot of what we do within our program, and it's not a lot, you know, it's just building relationships with the kids, getting to know them, getting to know what their strengths and weaknesses are, and then really talking to them and getting them to trust and believe in what we're talking about. And a lot of that has to do with, you know, behaving. You know, mm-hmm. if I do something that's going to be detrimental to my health and to my future, you know, you're not going to get to where you want to get to. So we have a lot of conversations within our program about doing the right thing all the time, mm-hmm. off the field, on the field, you know, and I think that that eventually is what builds the culture. But I think that the kids need to see that there's a light at the end of the tunnel past high school football, past their high school studies, you know, no matter what it is that they want to do or what they want to be. You're building your values and your life skills for what you're going to use for the rest of your life, not just for high school football. So that's a lot of what we try to do in our program, to try to build it to be more than just a football program, you know, be something that kids are going to be a part of. They're going to grow, they're going to learn discipline, and they're going to be able to be, you know, effective people in society in the future.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's great stuff. And because it's, you know, look at the percentages, right? Most of them are, you're not playing in the pros. Most of them aren't even playing at college. And so, you know,
right.
Those are things that are going to last. So, you know, culture, obviously you hear that all over now. You know, I think when I'm sitting down with you, now you're a basketball and football guy, but I think of you primarily as a football guy, just because, you know, you've been so successful in that range. Not to take away anything from your basketball coaching, but, you know, that's, I think if anybody knows you, you know, you're the head football coach. And I think no matter where you are, that's always, you know, takes prominence over other things. And so I think about, you know, PJ Fleck, the guy at Minnesota, mm-hmm. and watch this thing with him and just about how he's establishing his culture and he's like, row the boat and like everybody's on board. You know, so what types of things do you do to establish a culture on the field with your teams? Like, what do you think is really important to emphasize on that end?
Yeah. So, you know, I'm not a big like logo person. I'm not a big,
catchphrase.
Like, we don't have a catchphrase right. or anything like that. You right. know, for yeah. me, it's about, like I said before, building the relationships with the kids and getting the kids to trust and believe mm-hmm. in what you've done and how you've done it. And, you know, most of how you do that is through your experiences, right? So you can, you know, you can tell the kids what your experiences were and, you know, what it takes to be successful and how you got there and mm-hmm. things like that. So I think that that's how you build the culture. But for me, in terms of high school football, high school basketball, I think that the culture needs to be built before they even step on the field or the court. You know, we have to really focus on their academics, you know, improving. I'm not saying everybody should get straight A's, but mm-hmm. if they're D students, you know, get C's and B's, you know, improve that academic side, really prioritize improving your academics, you know, make it important. Then after that, you know, your home and your family life and off the field, off the court, like around town, you know, because when you're in high school, being around town is an important thing, right? Like, a lot of the little kids follow you. Yep. You know, everybody in town knows the football mm-hmm. team, the basketball team, the baseball kids. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, we live in Point Pleasant, right? Mm-hmm. And we knew who won the mile, the 3200 championship,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
And we knew yeah. the baseball team went really far,
yeah.
right? We're
yeah.
we're in town.
Right.
We get
right.
it, you know?
Right.
So just like those types of things, like representing yourself properly, that builds culture. You know, and then after that, you know, with regards to football and basketball, I mean, you know better than anybody, coach, that off-season program where kids are committed and dedicated to themselves and, you know, then they're dedicated to the coaches and the kids around them
mm-hmm.
to make something bigger than themselves, you know,
yeah.
and that's really what it comes down to. So I think that's how you build and create culture.
Yeah, no, those are great elements of it. You know, it's like the little kid, you nailed it. Like they look up to what's going on, and then those kids are going to be your future. In your case now, your future Huskies. You know, I believe that's Madawan mascot,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
So let's get into a little bit of practice. What's a good practice look like to you? And what do you want to achieve? And, you know, let's do both sports on this one.
Sure.
Let's start, we'll go by the seasons. Let's start with like a good football practice. And I know there's different practices. You're trying to achieve different things, but like overall, is there something within a practice that, you know, you can say, hey, this is what we want out of every practice. I don't know if, you know,
talk
about
yeah, that. Yeah. No, I know exactly what you're saying. So football, you only play one game a week, right? So you have a week's worth of practices. So we structure the practice schedule according to that week. So we have the same structure every week. We do the same thing Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, if we play Friday night or if we
mm-hmm.
play Saturday.
Yeah.
So we have great structure. A couple of things that we look at practice with football specifically is we watch a lot of film, we do a lot of game study, and we do a lot of things that will prepare the kids where if they're not great athletes or they can't just be better than the other team, you know, we're prepared for it. So
mm-hmm.
we do a lot of film study. We want to see that the kids are receptive and understanding to what we're trying to do as a team for that week, you know, to execute at
yeah.
a high level.
Can I interrupt you
sure.
there just for a second?
Yeah.
So your film study, talk about that a little bit. And I think this is an interesting question for different coaches is how do you delegate that out among your staff? And then when you find those things that you're looking for, how do you make sure that you're communicating what's really important from that film to your guys?
Right. So I think that it's a top-down approach. You know, we have an offensive coordinator and a defensive coordinator, and then we have a coach for each position. So you know, we have them all break down the film, and then we'll meet as a defense, as a defensive staff, as an offensive staff, and we'll put together the game plan as a group. You know, the defensive coordinator and the offensive coordinator obviously will have carte blanche. They'll have, mm-hmm. you know, the final say and everything. But, you know, the more eyes that see it in terms of coaching and the type of people that we have around the kids, the better that it is. So that's how we'll do it. We'll evaluate the film. And now with the technology, it's great because we don't have to meet for extended periods of time. We can watch on Huddle, on the internet, on our own. We can make notes and we can mm-hmm. do all this stuff on our yeah. own. I could be sitting 25 miles from you and we could be looking at yeah. the same thing mm-hmm. and communicating. You yeah. know? So
it's really amazing if you think about it.
It's unbelievable. Yeah. I can't believe I didn't think of it myself.
Yeah, you know? Right. I know.
It's like start a website and then load up film and now we can watch it. You know, it's crazy.
Yeah.
So that's a lot of the structure of what we do. And then we put the game plan together, and then once the game plan is in, we are on the same page as the coaching staff. We're all speaking the same language. You know, when it comes to sports, we talk about speaking the same language, yeah. right? Like, to you, it might be a button hook, but to me, it's a curl. Right. Now we need to be on the same page yeah. with what we're saying and how mm-hmm. we're saying it. So we do that over the course of the weekend, and then after that, we give it to the kids, and we let them know, we show them exactly what it is. And like you said, from a technology standpoint, we're very up to date with it. You know, mm-hmm. we can show specific plays, like we're going to run this against iPro. And if you look at play, you know, 22, 25, 27, this is their plays in iPro. And this is why we're doing this. And mm-hmm. kids can actually get mental reps through the film study when they watch the plays and mm-hmm. the way we give it to them, you know? Yeah. So I think that they're appreciative of that. So that's a lot of what we do with the film study. And then as coaches, you know, over the course of the week, we just do little tweaks, you know, little tiny tweaks here mm-hmm. or there. But for the most part, we have great conviction and great confidence in what we do over the course of the weekend to give the kids 4 or 5 days to prepare for the game on Friday night or Saturday.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you talk about giving confidence to a team and to a kid. Preparation is build your confidence. It's like, listen, we've gone through all this stuff. We're ready for what we see.
Sure.
Have you ever heard what Belichick does when he's hiring somebody? This is what I heard. Anyway, this is like the rumor. Apparently, he just gives you a game film, and then he gives them like 5 hours or whatever. I think that's the number. I could be quoting it wrong. It might be longer. And he's like, yeah, so just break this down for me. And then I want to, when we come back and meet again and you know, 6 hours, 5 hours, I want to hear what you saw on that film. And I thought that was that makes, when you know how awesome Belichick is and, you know, what his career is like, I'm like, oh, okay. That's a great, write that one down, right?
Yeah, no, he's a great coach. So yeah. Anything that he does is working.
Yeah, exactly. So what else do you want to see in a football practice?
Yeah, so then, you know, within the week, a lot of what we like to talk about now within a football practice is the pace of practice, right? Like, we don't want to be out there for 4 or 5 hours, you know, burning the midnight candle.
Yeah.
We want to be structured. We want to be fast-paced. We want to be prepared. You know, so we talk a lot about the pace of practice. So over the course of a Tuesday practice, if we have like a team session of some sort, it's maybe 20 minutes or a half hour. You know, we don't want to run plays slowly and walk through it and those things. All those types of mistakes and all those issues we see on the film, you know, and we correct it during the film session that we just talked about. Mm-hmm. You know, when we're on the field,
practice?
Yeah, we film practice.
Yeah.
And then we review practice and then we go over it the day before, you know, like the next day. You know, what went right, what went wrong, things like that. So we're very comprehensive with it. And,
yeah.
you know, the technology allows for it. So, you know, so during practice, we just talk about pace and, you know, going at a fast pace so that we can be conditioned. There's a lot of different things to it. So that's a lot about, you know, what we look at in a football practice, not getting into too many specifics.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we don't want to give away all your secrets here, right? You know what I mean? A couple new tricks for the short conference coming out. Did you ever look at what they did at Oregon with Chip Kelly in those practices? And obviously, you know, it worked at Oregon. It didn't work with the Eagles and everything. But did you, you know, that to me was really interesting because, you know, it seemed like they were doing things differently. And for, you know, they had other teams so ill prepared where part of the other team's way that they would combat it was they'd have guys fake ankle injuries and just go down so that Oregon couldn't get into their pace. Did you look at any of that, or was there something where pace, like what influenced you to really look at pace as something important to you, or did you just come up with it on your own?
No, you are right on the money there. Chip Kelly was, in my eyes, the originator of the true fast-paced offense and what you're trying to do. And, you know, I really looked a lot at Chip Kelly, Gus Malzahn when he was in high school, and then he eventually moved it up, and now he's at Auburn. And then Art Briles, who's gotten himself into a little bit of trouble, but from a pure football perspective, you know, he ran a very, very fast-paced offense at Baylor. So those are the types of different films and cut-ups and looks that we looked at. You know, how are they practicing? How are they calling plays? How are they getting plays in? How are they running a play and then getting on the ball and running another play within 5 seconds? The defense doesn't even have time to breathe, you know? So that's a lot of what, you know, me and our coaching staff have looked at in terms of the pace, because I think that football, with the rule changes of it being a little bit of a less violent game, less, you know, you can't hit the way that you want to at times. You know, you have to play in some respect at a fast pace. Even Nick Saban said it, right? Like, he's like, I hate that we have to play at a fast pace and we have to change the way we think.
Right.
But we really have to do it. That's what we have to do. You know, so he brought in Lane Kiffin and eventually Sarkisian and those guys. So, you know, it's just a part of evolving in the game. And, you know, those couple guys in particular are guys that I've, you know, Gus Malzahn has a book about it. And, you know, I read the book. And,
yeah.
And everything. So, yeah, so that's, you're exactly right.
What's the name of the Gus Malzahn book? You remember?
I forget what it is, but it's about 105 pages.
Okay.
He coached in high school at the time. He was at Texarkana High School, something like that. But it's about 90, 95 pages, quick read. But it goes on about the way that they call plays, the way that they can get plays into a game quicker. Because, you know, at this point, you know, you're looking at, do you change personnel? Do you, you know, a lot of the rules in college and the NFL have changed as a result of the way these guys have been running offense. So like when personnel packages are running in and out, you know, now they stop the game and they give the defense a chance to bring their personnel packages in. Whereas before that rule came into play, you know, Oregon was running a 4-wide set and throwing a quick pass and then coming in with 3 tight ends and then snapping the ball before you can even blink. Their defense had 13, 14 guys on the field, or they weren't prepared. They were in a nickel set. They had, you know, so then they had to change the rules. So
that's crazy. You
know, yeah.
Right. It was as, do you think the rule change was as a result of that?
100%.
That's crazy.
So a lot of the little bit older school coaches like Nick Saban and guys who aren't really hip to the fast paced game, they're sitting there and then they created it as like a safety issue. You know, if you're running an offense with 4 wide receivers and then you yell a word and they bring 3 tight ends in and they run a play quickly, I don't have time to react. I don't have time to get our kids into a safe situation on defense. So in other words, we have 6 D-backs in the game. It could be a safety issue, you know, so that's how they spun it. So that's why some of the rules have changed.
Yeah.
And then not to get, you know, too far off topic or anything.
No, no, go for it.
But that's why a lot of the, you know, like hybrid tight ends are such big money guys now, right? Like
Evan Ingram, right? You're a Giants.
Oh, yeah, Evan Ingram. Yeah, he's 4'4", 40, but he's 6'4", 230, 240. You know, you could play him in the slot and get him vertical down the field. He can block. You know, those types of guys are very prominent in the game now because they can play in the slot. They can play as a tight end. They can play as a fullback, and you don't have to change them out personnel-wise. So, you know, yeah, very interesting, great guys. They've really done a lot to improve the game of football. So it's been good, yeah.
Well, you know, to me, too, that brings up like an even bigger concept. And, you know, a big part of the reason, as we talked about, why I'm doing this is, you know, to try to continue to evolve as a coach. But that to me, when you hear Nick Saban saying that he has to change because the game is evolving and changing, to me, that's one of the beautiful things about being in, you know, I don't want to say the business of coaching, but being in coaching is like, you know, it's almost like playing an instrument. You can, or playing golf. You can always, there's always a different level. There's always another place to go. You can, it's always going to evolve, you know, like, and in every sport, you look at the pace in football, you look at the way like the NBA is right now, with, I feel like the traditional five center posting up, that's kind of, you know, but yeah, you know, and it's happened. Yeah. It's happening quicker. I think people are more receptive to that change, and it forces you to not be, you know, like growing up, it was like, okay, well, this is this and this is that. And, you know, I just think maybe it's a result of the way the information spreads quickly now. Like, as a coach, you can kind of go on to YouTube and I can watch whatever I want. I can go watch Dana Altman at Oregon basketball talk about, you know, the way he runs his spread offense, and I can sit there for an hour and take all that in. And so I don't know if that's a part of it, or if people somehow have been liberated from the idea of traditional stuff, or maybe it's just the old fashioned idea. Well, I'm going to beat you, and I'm just going to do something different, you know, and probably that's been around for a while, but you know, that's really interesting. Question I have for you. Oh, go ahead.
Sure. Well, what I was going to say is, you know, a lot of what you're talking about is exactly right. And I think a big piece of some of the change and some of the evolving of the sports, football and basketball specifically, is the analytics side and the statistics side. So, like, you know, from a basketball perspective, like a team like the Houston Rockets are like, if we get 120 shots in a game, yeah, if 80 of them are three-pointers, you know, 40 of them are two-pointers, we know we're 60% from two-point, you know, and they start to weigh those options. You know, like, I think that a guy like Steph Curry and Klay Thompson, the Splash Brothers, they've revolutionized the game simply because they're like, listen, we'll give up two and then we'll score three, you know? So, like, some of those analytics of, like, getting a certain amount of three-pointers in a game, things like that, and to the football side, like, if we run 70 plays in a game as opposed to 50 plays in a game, you know, we have the opportunity to be more successful. So I think a lot of, you know, just circling back to the technology side and the statistics and the analytics side is really important to the way that these games are being structured now, you know, like the NBA, you're exactly right. Like, you cannot step on the court of an NBA game right now without being able to shoot a three-pointer. It's just the way it is. No. You know, there are dinosaurs out there that are still playing a little bit, like Dwight Howard and a couple other guys. But to be quite honest, if you can't step out and shoot a three, it doesn't matter if you're 6'5 or 7'5, 7'3, it doesn't matter. You need to be able to step out and shoot a three. So, that's the way that the game has evolved.
It's interesting. And, in talking like a couple of years ago, I'm not going to give up which college because I feel like this was kind of they gave us some inside scoop, but they were talking about like statistics and looking at them differently. And one of the things they talked about was what like their success level after one of their guys dove on the floor for a loose ball. And it was so surprising. Well, it wasn't surprising. It's probably something you know, but the momentum that created and the sort of scoring runs they would go on after they had a guy dive on the floor. So, you know, in basketball, like obviously you're like, hey, get on the floor, take charges, be physical and all that. But then when you can marry that side of the hustle and toughness to analytics, now it's like a little easier to sell it. Like, hey, if we get on the floor, this is literally what's happening, guys. We've gone on runs of 8, 7, 10, you know.
Oh, absolutely.
And that's interesting. That's something that, you know, even 5 years ago, maybe 6 years ago, at least at the high school level, I don't think we were tracking. But now, honestly, like Huddle, I pay them an extra $750 and they stat all our games. I have like, you know, where we shot from, our assist total, our turnovers, like so many different things, like even higher level stats than that. And that, I feel like that's really, it's made me more efficient as a coach as far as time spent. And, you know, it's made everybody better, to your point. And, you know, things evolve from there. Like, so let's talk about this. So how's a basketball practice different than a football practice for you?
Yeah. So, basketball is a lot different, right? Because football, you play one game a week. So right. It's basically a week worth of practice for one game. Basketball, you could have 3, 4, 5 games in a week. You may only practice 2 days in a week and play 4 games. You know, it's just kind of the way it is. So for me, being in New Jersey, you know, it's cold in the winter. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of our practice is structured I always like to do a lot of ball handling drills and team ball handling mm-hmm. and things like that. So the kids get used to playing with each other. And then after that, I always like to do a lot of shooting, you mm-hmm. know, because, back in the day we would go out on our own and shoot, you know, right. I would go out in my backyard with my sisters and shoot the ball all night long.
Yeah.
We would play with the wind, you know, whatever the case was, we would do it. Quite honestly, kids aren't doing that anymore. You know, they go outside and they're like, oh, well, it's too cold or it's too this, the elements are too much for them. So I always like to have a good amount of shooting within a practice, because for that 2 hour practice that we have, that's really the only time that they're touching a basketball or they're shooting a basketball. Mm-hmm. So if they get a couple hundred shots up during that, I think that that's helpful for them. And then after that, it's all game preparation, right? I mean, you have to be able to prepare for the next team for, you know, 10 minutes, 20 minutes, whatever mm-hmm. it is, however long you need for that team. So basketball practices are structured a lot differently. The whole season, quite mm-hmm. honestly, is structured differently than football.
So. Yeah. Yeah. Quick turnarounds and it can be, you know, and then when you're trying to get the film together and get prepared and be ahead, maybe be a game ahead, 2 games ahead, at least knowing what you're going to want to do for that. It can definitely be a lot, but you know, like I think Indiana, at least back in the day, they probably play more games now, but I think back in the day, they used to just play like games Friday, Saturday or something like that.
Right. Well, there was a lot of like back then there was an academic proponent to it, that a guy like Bob right. Knight was like, listen, our kids are going to graduate. They're going to do well in school. So we're not going to play 4 nights a week. Right. Right?
Yeah.
So,
that it definitely, the pace of the season is a thing, but at the same time, yeah, there's more games, but getting your guys out on a cold, rainy day in November outside, or, you know, let's say October, because November, if you're out there, maybe you're in the mix for, I don't know, a playoff spot. And so, you know, hey, yeah, we're going down the rain. It might rain on Saturday. Talk about that a little bit. Do the elements, is there a way to prepare your kids for the elements? Do you do anything differently as far as that goes? Like, do you talk to your guys about, hey, it's going to be cold out, like, just get used to it? Do you address it? Do you just...
Yeah, we try to address everything, right? I mean, in football, we talk a lot about controlling the things that you can control, right? Control the things you can control. You can't control the refs. You can't control the weather. You can't control those things. What you can control is what we've talked about in terms of executing at a high level, the way that you conduct yourself, the way that you prepare. You can control those things. In basketball, it's the same thing. A lot of basketball now is refs and getting on refs and things like that. Mm. I try to tell our kids in basketball, worry about the things that you can worry about. Control the things you can control. Play tough defense. Stop your guy. We play mostly man-to-man. We do mm-hmm. some zone, but
yeah.
I mean, that's a lot of what we do. So that's what we talk about. Don't worry about the refs. Don't get yourself caught up in that. Let me worry about that, right? You just worry about doing what you have to do and getting to the next play and executing at the level that we want you to, right? I mean, it's maddening sometimes to see kids, and it's – I don't want to blame the NBA or any of that stuff, but you see NBA game and it's complain, 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 and then the kids see that. And then all of a sudden you have a kid on your team that's complaining about everything, and they completely forget how to play the game of basketball sometimes because they're just complaining so much. So a lot of what we talk about is to control the things that you can control and don't worry about the things you can't.
I'm almost like, and I really haven't been preaching this, but I kind of want to start it. I almost want to, and now I obviously lose my temper maybe more than I'd like. And I think sometimes emotionally as a coach, when you kind of lose it a little bit on a referee, I take a step back and I'm like, well, am I really being the best coach I can be by doing this? Am I modeling what I'm asking them to do? And easier said than done, you know, the emotions run high. But I'm almost to the point where I've thought about this before, like, God bless whoever wants to be a referee. Like, thank God that people want to go out there and actually ref games. And, you know, it's probably, you know, a lot of the guys maybe are older, even, and a lot of guys are really good, and a lot of guys will give you a rope and they'll listen to you. Like, that's my whole thing. Like, if my big pet peeve is, guy goes up for a layup, guy slides in for a charge, they both crash into each other and there's no call at all.
Right.
Like, we're going to pretend like that didn't happen. Like, that to me. So, and then a lot of my take when I'm trying to be calm and I'm trying. So, if my guy tried to step in and take the charge, was he there late? Was he moving? Like, tell me so I can coach that.
Right.
And it gets to me when I can't even get an answer. You know, in a dead ball situation, it's like, just tell me what he did. Like, that's, right. and I'm fine. But when it's like, you know, I'm not even going to give you that, coach, that's when it's like, whatever. But anyway.
Well, you know, I think in terms of refs, I think that majority of the refs understand the amount of time and the amount of passion that we have for the game that we're coaching. Right.
Yeah.
And a lot of that seeps onto the court, whether it's through to your players or to the refs or mm-hmm. whatever the case is. So as a ref, you know that you're reffing a game where there's two passionate coaches mm-hmm. with 10 guys on the court who are passionate about the game.
Mm-hmm.
The way that we coach and the way we are, right? Yeah,
throwing a crowd.
And there's a lot of crowd and a lot of that. So as a ref, you have to have that understanding. And I think there's times where us as coaches, we want our information right now, right? We want to know what happened, and I want to know right now, right?
Right.
Whereas a ref has to ref an entire game, and sometimes it's like, I'll get back to you, things like that.
Yeah.
Majority of the refs that I've come across, football and basketball, they are just in it because they love being a part of the game.
Yeah.
Maybe they don't have the time or the mm-hmm. job structure to be able to coach.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So just to be involved in part of the game
mm-hmm.
is important to them. So reffing on a Friday night, reffing on a Saturday, and during basketball, reffing on a Tuesday, Friday night slate, being a part mm-hmm. of the game is something that's important to them. And I think that they have a lot of respect for the passion that we possess. Now, there's a line that is crossed, right, where you start berating them. And I think when it gets personal, that's
when the problems occur. No doubt.
So,
and again, and that's a – you know, to never say never. Like, there's going to be situations when there's humans involved, like you're just going to get worked up, and you know, so it happens. You try to limit it as much as possible. I made a rule a couple of years ago. It was like, you know, hey, whoever gets it, if any of you guys get a technical, you're all running. And then turns out I ended up leading the team in technicals. And so I took it. I'm like, I got to do a suicide, you know, it's on me. Like, yeah, I did it. And, I feel like the kids, funny enough, you know, they do get a kick out of that when it's like, all right, well, it's a small instance where you're able to kind of walk the walk and, you know, practice what you preach. Even though on the flip, well, it's like, hey guys, when I behave badly, there's consequences. But the other thing with a ref, when you talk about your kids talking to refs, what adult wants to hear anything from a 16-year-old kid and it's going to give you a call down the road, like, you little punk? You think, like, you know, like, it's just going to make this situation worse. So yeah, you know, and again, it's easier said than done. I don't know how you calm yourself down. I saw something with Danny Hurley, who, you know, is a very fiery coach, UConn right now. And I read something with him where he really needed to calm down across the board, like outside of coaching, everything. He was just taking it all to heart. It got to where he was at Rhode Island. He was saying where he was winning games and he still wasn't happy. Right. And so then I heard him, he's like drinking these teas that are supposed to be calming and everything else, which kind of brings me to my next question for you is, so how do you find that balance? And, you know, you're head coach at two big time varsity sports in basketball and football. You're married, you have a new son, which congratulations on that.
Thank you.
So how do you find a balance in all that?
Sure. So, I am not the head varsity coach of two sports anymore.
Anymore.
This is my first year. Yeah. So the prior, I was the head varsity basketball coach for 8 years and football for nine. So yeah. I've been doing this for 8 years.
3 years, almost a decade. That's a long run, man.
Well, I wasn't married for the first half of it. So okay. That was my 4 year anniversary was yesterday, actually. honestly, I'm going to be completely honest. I found the right woman. She understands completely what my goals and passion are. I think the reason why she actually likes me and loves me is because of that.
Yeah. Well, she was an athlete too, right? I remember you talking about that before. Yeah.
Yeah. She played basketball. She played at Immaculate Heart Academy up in North Jersey, played at TCNJ. She was an All-American soccer player. So she's complete understanding of what the dedication is to a sport, to be really good at it.
And, yeah.
You know, to have passion for it. So going into it, I let her know this is who I am. This is what I do. If you don't like it or agree with it, we can move on. But you know, a part of why I think we love each other is because of the passion we have. She's a history teacher and she has an incredible passion for it. You know, she spends hours upon hours developing lessons, what the anticipatory set is going to be to get the kids interested. You know, a history, maybe 30 kids in a class, maybe 12 are interested. How am I going to get those other 18 kids interested? Mm-hmm. You know, so my wife knew right away what my passion was and what my interests were. So that being said, she has a full ton of respect for me and knowing my past that I've always played three sports and then played sports in college and things like that. So she's been great. She's been a saint. She's allowed me to do the things that I need to do in order to be successful. It does get sticky at times because football and basketball ran into each other for like 3 or 4 years when we made the playoffs and we went deep. So, you know, but she's my rock. She's my top person and she supports me in every way. And it's been great. Having a kid is great too. He's 8 weeks old now and it's been good. Everything's been really good.
Yeah, no, it's awesome. I remember, you know, I guess it was, I don't know, might've been 2 years ago. When at Allentown did you guys win the state championship? Was that 2 years ago?
We 2016.
2016. So,
yeah, two football seasons ago.
Two football. Yeah. But then you went to the final in 2015, right?
14.
In 14, okay.
Yeah, so 14.
So, but I remember when we played you guys, I remember, like, because, you know, I obviously, you know, you just pay attention to sports in the area and everything else. And I'm like, wow, this guy, I'm like, they're playing in the state finals and, you know, and basketball is going on. So, and I remember asking you and I remember being like astounded. So you were going football from what to what, and then you were doing basketball and then how long, you know what I mean? You were doing double duty.
Sure. Yeah. So, so another portion of it for me personally was I have a finance degree, so I still have to go to school to get my certifications to be a teacher, right? So I'm taking master's courses and classes over the course of this time, like three courses.
And then
teaching a couple classes, your teaching schedule, which is arduous too. You have a lot of things that you have to accomplish in terms of lesson plans and SGOs and things like that. And then we were going football from about 2 to 7 or so. And then we were doing basketball like 7:30, 9:30 or 8 to 10. Yeah, it was a lot. It was a lot. And then
hats off
for the classes and stuff. So, but look, I've somebody told me to do it all while you're young, right? So that, because when you get older and you have a house and you have kids,
yeah,
you start to, like, going back to school is a lot harder to do. So,
of course,
you know, just very happy that I was able to do it at a young age and get all some of that stuff over with.
Yeah. Well, you know, and I kind of keep going back to, too, back to that Nick Saban thing and with the advice that somebody just gave you, like, you know, it's easier to go to school when you're younger. And obviously, again, now you're a new dad and everything else, but look, just, I feel like there's a part of us that is always, as you know, we've all heard, you can't teach an old dog new tricks. And I really think that it's those of us who can, you gotta, I think there's gotta be a level of humility and you gotta be like, you know, I don't know everything and I want to just keep learning. And in school, we talk about it, you know, with our students, like being lifelong learners. But I think sometimes maybe as coaches, we don't really take that to heart. And I don't know. I think it's to maybe our, like, no, I know that. No,
well, I don't listen. You know, I hope that's not the case, because you're doing something like this to, you know, be able to grab information. I know that you go to camps and clinics and things like that, and you're always reading up on coaches and, you know, different things like that. And I am too. You know, any coach that thinks that they know it all, they're simply wrong. You know, we're always continuing to learn and try to grow from everybody else.
So. And I think that, anyway, I think that that's something, you know, younger coaches that end up listening to this, it's like, just, that's what you have to do. And it's not just coaching, it's whatever field you're involved in. I think you just always learn and it's going to make you better and it continues to challenge you. And, you know, you don't get stagnant and maybe you don't get bored and, you know, Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the playoffs. As we said before, in 2014, when you were the coach at Allentown, you guys made it all the way to the state final. And then in 2016, you ended up winning that state final. So walk me through a little bit of that 2014 season, what made that group successful, and kind of that whole experience of making it down there, I think you guys played at Rowan, and how that then helped you get over the hump the next time you made it down. So,
yeah, sure. So, my second and third year coaching was the first and second time that Allentown had ever been to the playoffs, 2011 and 12.
Okay.
And those were, I thought that our 2012 team was the best team we ever had. And we lost in the semifinals to Neptune. That year we beat Nottingham, and Nottingham won the state championship.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the team that I thought, still to this day, I think was our best team. But those kids on the 14 team, they were sophomores at the time. So they kind of, you know, they had that pit in their stomach, mm-hmm, of the tough loss that we had against Neptune. We lost in overtime, and it was a tough
game. Where'd you get to play that game, that Neptune game?
It was at our place.
Oh, okay.
They were like, I think we were the 2 and they were the 3, or 1-4, something right, like that.
By the semifinals, wherever you're playing, you know, whoever you're playing is going to be good. And, you know, to have it at your place is one thing.
Right. And Neptune was fantastic. They had like 4 or 5 Division I players. Mark Ciccatelli was the coach. He has a couple state championships at Freehold Borough. And he's a very good coach. So, you know, we were up against it, but, you know, we didn't win. But then when they were sophomores, they were at that game. And a couple of them played a little bit, but not as much as they, you know, probably would have, or as much as they did as seniors. So they really took it personal, that group, and they said, you know, we're going to get to this game again. We're going to get to the final before it. So in 14, that group of kids, just tough, gritty group of kids, they would run through a wall. They would literally do anything that it took to be successful. They were really for each other. And a lot of what we talked about earlier, right, like that hometown feel, they grew up together since they were 3, 4, 5 years old. They did everything together, and they were just a tough, gritty group of kids. I remember we lost to Lenape, who was ranked like 10th in the state. We lost 18-14, and we got stuffed at the goal line on the last play of the game, 4th and goal from like the 1-foot line, and we got stuffed on the last play of the game. And went into the locker room and looked at the kids, and, you know, look, these kids are emotional. They love the game, and they were crying, right? They were they were upset. We put a lot of time. Lenape's top 10 team in the state, great team. We had them on the ropes, and guess what? We didn't win. We got beat, right? We got beat by a foot. We didn't get there. You know, we didn't win. Mm-hmm. So, you know, just looked at the kids and said, don't ever let this happen again. Mm-hmm. let's fuel this, you know? And that was something that really fueled us to get to the final that year. That was South Group 3. We were at Rowan, and we were playing Delcy, who was the 2 or 3-time state champs. They're perennial power. Great team. They were a lot bigger than us, physical, faster, stronger, all that. But I think that we had a great game plan. We got down twice in the game by 2 touchdowns, and we ended up coming back, going to overtime, and we lost in overtime, which was really tough. It was in a driving rainstorm. You know, and some of the things that I didn't know about personally as a coach, because it was my first time going to a final, were some of the little rules and logistics that go into it, right? So you're not allowed to be at the game until like an hour and a half before the game. And, you know, they give you a whole packet of rules and regulations because you're playing at a college, you're playing at somebody else's place, you know? So there were some little rules and regulations that we learned about during that time. But I'll never forget walking off that field in 2014, getting on the bus, and I'm drenched and soaked and looking and saying to my assistant coach, we're never going to get back to a final. Like, it was so hard. Mm-hmm. The kids worked so hard. They put so much time in. Everything was just clicking right. You know, like when you're on a championship team, mm-hmm. you get lucky. Things click right. No injuries. You know, it's like the perfect storm.
Yeah.
We got there. We had them on the ropes in overtime. You know, we get beat in overtime. I'm on the bus and I'm like, we're never going to get back here again. You know, that was our shot, you know, so
yeah,
it was tough in 14.
Yeah, that's so then you make it back there in 16. What happens in between there? Does that experience change you at all? Losing in the final, does that like, what does that do for you? Like, are you, you know, because it seems like you're, by that point, sounds like you had a pretty solid plan in place in terms of your process on a weekly basis and what you wanted to do. Did you tweak anything? Was there something that you felt like mentally changed? Or did you just stick with what you were doing and take a deep breath and say, let's just soldier on and see what happens?
Good question. I think that, you know, we knew the formula that we had as coaches had a chance to be successful. Mm-hmm. And I think that season validated it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think just ramping up one or two little things here and there in 15 and then again in 16 mm-hmm. is what we did in order to get the kids prepared and ready. So that by the time 2016 came, we knew exactly what the goal was from the beginning of the season. You never look ahead, you know, but you know what you need to do in order to get to the finish line, right? Does that make sense?
Yeah, like, it totally,
you know,
does.
So
my only question was going to be, can you like name those specific things? Was there like, listen, like for instance, you know, you get to that point, that's a long season. Was it like, hey, well, when we get to this point again, our practices are going to be shorter, or they're going to be longer, or, you know, we're not going to say this or that to the kids before the game, or, you know, we're not going to run this. We're not going to throw a new defense at them 2 weeks into the playoffs, or, you know, anything like that, that you remember.
Right. I think one of the main proponents to winning a championship and, or getting to a championship game is you have to get punched in the face at some point. Like mm-hmm. your team mm-hmm. has to get knocked in the face. You have to get knocked down to the ground. And then you have to build off of that adversity. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a fork in the road. It's a very simple quote,
yep.
right? Fork mm-hmm. in the road.
Yeah.
You know, you get knocked down on your face. Are you going to get up and you're going to respond, or are you just going to stay there, lay down? You know, mm-hmm. everybody, you know, Mike Tyson said it, and I'll never forget this quote, and we all know
yep.
it, right?
Yeah. Go ahead and say it. Oh, yeah, no, exactly.
I mean,
yep.
everybody has a plan until they get punched in the face, right?
Yep.
I think that a big part of building a successful season is getting punched in the face, quite honestly. And then
mm-hmm.
how are you going to respond off of that?
Mm-hmm.
So 2016, we got beat in a couple games. And I think that we built off of that strong, and our our kids were really ready in the playoffs. They were ready to get it done. Because again, just like we talked about in 14, mm-hmm. those kids were sophomores in 14, and right. they were there. They were right. there for the overtime loss, and that and their stomach mm-hmm. was there. Where we were like, we're not getting back here and losing. You know, so everything kind of, you know, built off of that.
So 16. Now the game is at Rutgers.
Yeah.
And so in 16, are you Central 5 or 4?
4.
Okay, so Central 5 wasn't four. Out yet, right? In 16 or?
Yeah, 5 was Manalpin, South Brunswick. So okay. We were 4, yeah.
Okay. So who did you play in that final?
Brick Township.
Okay, so also storied program over there, right? I feel like they've had some success over the years.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Is that the Warren Wolf program?
Yep.
Is that his name? Warren Wolf?
Warren
Wolf, yeah. So how was that game different? How did that game end? And, you know, so.
Sure. So we, you know, we a lot more experienced now with what it took and how it took to get there. So we were able to, you know, get to the game early. It was a cold day. It was like in the 20s, 30s, mm-hmm. you know. And when we got to Rutgers, we had a choice. We could either practice in the bubble, very comfortable, convenient, mm-hmm. or we could practice out on the practice field. With the elements. So the first thing that we did was I said, look, tell the kids to get ready to play. We're practicing out on the practice field.
Is it a day prior or that day?
No, that day. Oh, yes. That day. Okay. We played 4 o'clock on a Saturday.
Okay.
So, yeah. So told the kids, we're going out to the practice field. We're battling the elements in the warm-up, mm-hmm. and that's what I think is going to get us ready and prepared. And Brick stayed inside. They stayed in the mm-hmm. bubble. So I thought right from the jump, I thought we were more ready than them because we were outside. We were in the elements and mm-hmm. little things like that.
Yeah.
When you're experienced and you're there, you know, mm-hmm. which we didn't know in 2014. Yeah. So, you know, right from the start, that was what we had. And then, you know, we started that game fast. We scored. We were up 27-0 at the half. So, you know, we started quick. Ooh. And kids really executed at a high level, and they weren't going to be denied. Like I said, they were there in 14 when we got, you know, we were left at the doorstep, quite honestly, in overtime.
So, well, that's to me, you know, that's a really interesting thing because sometimes playing with a lead, in 27-0, that's a big lead, but obviously we watched the Patriots come back on the Falcons a couple of years ago in the Super Bowl, and, you know, they were up, I think, 23 at one point or whatever it was, 24. And obviously you never count out going back to Belichick again or Brady, but so you're in the locker room at halftime up 27-0. What's the message? What are you going in? Like, what are you going in with? Cause the kids aren't right. stupid.
Yeah.
They well, know like it's on right now. We're in them. And yeah, you know, so what do you say?
Well, so we were up 27-0 with a couple minutes left in the half, and we got the ball back, and we drove down to, like, the 2-yard line, and we threw an interception at the goal line, or Ooh. Else it would have been 34-35-0.
Wow.
You know, in high school football, when you get to 35 points, the clock runs. That's kind of like the mercy rule.
Right.
I like it. I think that once it gets to 35, you run the clock, you kind of get the other kids in. That's, mm-hmm. You know, you're not yeah. running up the score on teams. Yeah. You know, we get into that, you know, a little bit in basketball, right, where we can, yeah. like, we get buried or we bury teams. I've been on both yeah. sides of it, basketball uh-huh. and football too.
For sure.
But, you know, so if we would have got to that 34, 35 number, it kind of would have been, you know,
mm-hmm.
would have been over. But, you know, 14, 21, 27 points up in football, that's still – you're still not that comfortable,
mm-hmm.
you know. So we just went into the half and told the kids what the goal was. We continued to preach what the goal was and – just try to tell them that it was 0-0 and mm-hmm. don't be denied. You
yeah.
know, don't let what you did in the first half go to waste. And you know, that's what we did. We came out and got a stop and a couple more scores, made it 41-0, and that was it. But, you know, it's not an easy conversation to have at the half with 14 to 18-year-old kids.
No.
Right, Coach?
No.
You're up and you're like, all right, guys, let's yeah. start fitting the rings. And yeah. then all of a sudden it's right. 27-14 and
yeah.
you're punting and here they come. Right. You know, so.
And now everybody's a little more – we're all looking at each other differently and, you know, yeah, so.
We had a game this year against Steiner when I was at Allentown this past year, and it was like 21 or 27-0 and – you know, we're sitting there and as a head coach, you're focused, you're on the next play, you know, mm-hmm. but like you start to hear a little bit around the kids, mm-hmm. a couple of the coaches are talking mm-hmm. about where we're going tonight and mm-hmm. what we're doing and all that. And it's mid third quarter. Next thing you know, you give up a big play, then you give up another one and it's like 27-14 mm-hmm. and they have the ball back, you know, like it happens that quick. Mm-hmm. So, and we just tried to keep them focused just like we all do as coaches, yeah. and it's not easy to do.
But, right.
You know, so.
So how about this? You, a young coach comes to you, 23, at a coworker or something like that, or somebody you talk, maybe you meet at a football clinic or somewhere, you know, what advice would you give to a young coach, trying to come up, and a guy maybe who wants to eventually be a head football coach or a head basketball coach somewhere? What would you say to them?
Sure. So my advice to them would be to be a worker. Be the absolute hardest worker in the room at all times. You know, there's nothing that football coaches want to see more than a guy who works. You mm-hmm. know, don't cheat yourself. Don't cheat the team. Don't slight anything, because you're not going to get to where you want to get to unless you're the hardest worker mm-hmm. in the room. You know, so if you're a young guy, you're young, you don't have to sleep a lot. You don't have a lot of responsibilities, you know, be a worker, be mm-hmm. a guy who is there all the time, willing to learn, willing to go to camps and clinics, willing to do whatever it takes to be successful, because you just never know when you're going to get your chance. I mean, I got lucky. I'm an outlier and I got lucky. Mm-hmm. Like, not a lot of people get a job at that age.
Yeah.
And like I said, I got very lucky. Like, the program almost shut down, you know, it was a dying program, you know, so, you know, I was very lucky. I didn't think that I would get that lucky. So, you know, being the freshman football coach my first year, I took it really serious. I thought that I was like, you know, Vince Lombardi. I treated it like I was Vince Lombardi. It was a freshman football team.
Yeah.
But that's how you have to go into every situation. So that would be my advice to young coaches, you know, go into every situation like you're, you know, Mike Krzyzewski in the Final Four, or you're, you know, Vince Lombardi coaching. Like, take it really serious. Don't listen to the noise outside. Don't listen to what other people say, that you're a tryhard and all that mm-hmm. stuff. You know, really work hard and dig your heels in and be dedicated, because, you know, these sports that we talk about are great. And we've only talked football, basketball, but baseball, lacrosse, soccer, they're great sports too. And they give back to you, you know, in terms of your passion. So, you know, put it in and it'll come back to you.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. It does come back to you. But it's funny when – well, so you saying that when you were coaching the freshman team, you know, coach it like you're Vince Lombardi or Mike Krzyzewski, you know, the Jim Valvano story, the very, you know, he was the freshman coach at Rutgers, and he was like obsessed with Lombardi. And like the first game, he charges into the locker room, and his intent was to steal from Lombardi. You know, the only thing that you care about is God, your family. And he's going to say the Rutgers Scarlet Knights, but instead he just said God, your family, and the Green Bay Packers, because that's what Lombardi said. And that was like his first thing. So it strikes me as funny, but it also, I think, kind of unintentionally, clearly Valvano went on to be a good coach, and what he's known for is his passion. And I think that's interesting that you brought him up and like kind of compared that to your experience as a freshman coach. And
So one big piece of advice that I got was when I was a freshman in college, I had a defensive coordinator, his name was Greg Gigantino, when I was at Hofstra. And, you know, you're a freshman in college, right? Mm-hmm. You're coming off being the man in high school. You're the senior, you're all state in a couple sports, you know, mm-hmm. like you're flying high, right? Then all of a sudden you get to college and you're knocked right back down. You're knocked right back down to the bottom, right? So a lot of times that's a hard adjustment for athletes, right? To get knocked back down a peg. And mm-hmm. I wasn't, I'll be completely honest, I was 18, 19 years old, and I wasn't taking it very well, because I was the man before, mm-hmm. you know, and I wasn't taking it very well being on the scout team, being like the third or fourth string guy. You know, you have guys ahead of you and all that. So Greg Gigantino, our defensive coordinator at Hofstra at the time, brought me in, And he's like, you know, you look like your cat or your dog died out there. Like, what's going on? And I'm like, well, coach, I should be playing. I should be this. I should be that. Mm-hmm. I was just feeling myself, you know? Yeah. And he's like, listen, like, I'm going to tell you right now, knock it off and be quiet. Like, if you were the best guy out there, we would put you out there because we all get paid for you to be the guy, you know? Right. Like, right. So if you're going to win us games, you would be the guy out there, not the three guys ahead of you. But here's the deal. You're the scout team quarterback, okay? You need to be like Joe Namath in Super Bowl III. You need to go out there and you need to work and you need to treat every single play like you're in the Super Bowl beating the Baltimore Colts in Super Bowl III. And that's how you have to play scout team. So, you know, I kind of took my rubbing there like we should, you know. Mm-hmm. I took my beating there and listened to that advice, and that was great advice, right? Like, no matter what situation you're in, whether it's where you want to be or whether it's something you think is good or whatever the case is, you know, put your best foot forward. And he was exactly right. And so that's how I've approached everything from then on out. I've approached it as like, all right, this is my Super Bowl, whether it's mm-hmm. anybody else's or not, I don't care.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's hell of a piece of advice. And it's not an easy place to get to mentally either. Like, you got to really, you know, take a step back and truly be humble. That's called being humbled. And then to get yourself getting over that hump, be like, okay, well, this is what I got to do. That takes a lot. That's not something the average person has to do, but it also doesn't take any physical talent to have that mentality. You can come in and be like, okay, well, I'm just going to come in and work my butt off and do my absolute best, whatever your skill level or whatever, wherever you're at. And I think that's something that could transfer to every element of life. Okay, so we're going to get to our around the world segment right now. And so we'll start with your favorite coaches, because I know you wanted to talk about a couple coaches here. So why don't we start with that?
Sure. So football, my one of my favorite coaches is Dabo Swinney, and the reason why is because the way he's able to build relationships with kids, the way that he's able to recruit and bring kids in, you know, legally illegal, all those types of conversations you have. You mm-hmm. know, I don't really focus on that. What I focus right. on is, you know, Alabama has really been the premier team, right, with Nick Saban every year in and year out. Even if they don't win it, they're in the hunt. You know, they have been in the hunt the last 7, 8, 9 years. Yeah. They are the hallmark team.
Yep,
and, you know, I think that the way that Dabo Swinney has been able to build Clemson in the last 3 or 4 years to kind of reach that is fantastic. And, you know, Clemson isn't – Alabama's a state, right? California, mm-hmm. yeah. You have your Ohio State, Michigan. Clemson is in South Carolina. Yeah. It's not even like the premier school yeah. technically in the state.
No, I agree.
He's been able to do that there. And then basketball-wise, there's two main guys that I like. The first is Brad Stevens, the mm-hmm. ability to get to the finals 2 years in a row at Butler. I mean, Butler is a low-level Division I school.
Yeah.
you know, he's going further than Duke and Kentucky and North Carolina and all these schools that have the top recruits in the country. The way that he coached the team, the way that he managed the game, the way that he was calm and his temperament, you know, and now he's with the Celtics, but I'm talking about when he was at Butler.
Oh,
you know,
of course.
The way he coached there.
Yeah, that's why he got the Celtics job. Danny Ainge was like, this guy, I'm willing to bet some serious money that this guy's going to be a great NBA coach. And, you know, I think he's a good coach. Obviously, you know, the Kyrie situation this year, if I was him, I'd be like, see ya, Kyrie. I'd rather play with my guys that I had the year before. I'm with you on the Brad Stevens for sure.
Yeah, and, you know, it was unfortunate that Gordon Hayward broke his leg in that first game.
Yeah.
You know, so the last 2 years they have a max player who's really a shell of himself as a result of that.
Yeah.
Because if Gordon Hayward was healthy, he's one of the best players in the league. So who knows how Kyrie would have reacted and things like that. So, but, you know, listen, he still made the playoffs, second or third best team in the Eastern Conference.
Yeah.
You know, really
yeah.
done a good job there. But, You know, and then the other guy is Shaka Smart at VCU. You know, went to the Final Four. I think that they were the last – one of the last four in. Then were George Mason.
Yeah, one of the two. Same conference.
But a lot of why I like Shaka Smart is because of a lot of just what I read about him. You know, the way he conducts himself, the way he talks, the way he coaches. You know, the one article that I love about him is he says – you know, we all know plays. We all coach plays. We all coach defense. We all coach shooting. You know, we're all really good at that, right? Because mm-hmm. we all know the game. We've mm-hmm. been around it. Like, we've all been around it. Every coach, and I'm no different. And he said, you know, but my biggest thing with coaching now is building the relationships with the kids and getting them to believe what I say and how I say it, you know? Like, he said that there was a kid who – wasn't playing well, and he had somebody else in his ear and about going pro and all this stuff. And he kind of sat the kid down one day and he was like, you know, listen, don't worry about what the media said about you, because the media was on him and mm-hmm. he was catching feelings about that. Mm-hmm. And he said, don't worry about what the media says. Don't worry about what this guy says about your NBA draft status. You know, just worry about what I say, you know. And he talks a lot about if he as a coach can get the kids just locked in and focused on what they want to do and what they want to accomplish as a team, then they're going to go where they need to go, you know, because everybody has good players. Everybody has good schemes. You know, it's now it's the ability to get those kids locked in and focused on what you're trying to accomplish as a team and as a group, and then getting them to believe that if we accomplish something certain as a team, then you will get to where you need to get to individually. You know, there's not a lot of guys who make it to where they want to get to on 5 and 25 teams. You know? Yeah. So that's a lot about what he talked about. And it was just a very interesting couple articles and conversations that he had with regard to the mental state of his players. So I always like love watching him and admire him. And now he's at Texas, so I'm not really sure. I think they're doing okay. I think they just missed the tournament this year.
Yeah, yeah. It's weird. It's a weird thing. I feel like I would have – I'm like, yeah, he'll turn that around. And weirdly, seems like he hasn't. But, yeah, I steal a drill from Shaka, and I got it online. It's like it's a hustle drill, and it has your guys come in, take a charge. You know, like so somebody dribbles down and – just kind of got to slide in and take a charge. Then somebody else rolls the ball to half court. The guy who took the charge has to stand up. You dive on the floor for the loose ball, throw it up to another guy who's waiting, and then you got to like finish a layup. And my, you know, I don't know how much longer I could do it, but that's when we do that drill, I purposely put myself in there first, and I'll take the charge and do it. And the kids get all crazy about it. And that's like the go-to drill. Like if I feel like we need more toughness, like we didn't play tough in a particular game, that's what we'll start practice with. And it's so funny because if there's any like dread among the kids, I don't see it because 30 seconds into the drill, you know, we always talk about talking and having energy and stuff like that. Everybody's hooting and hollering because now everybody's taking a hit. Everybody's diving on the floor. And it kind of goes, again, back to that stat we talked about earlier. Like, what kind of a run do we go on after somebody dives on the floor and makes that hustle play? Right. And that's stolen directly from Shaka. And I just saw him do it himself. So I was like, all right, he's probably about my age. I could probably keep doing this until. Right. But every like now I'm doing it. I'm like, all right, is this the day? Is this the day?
Is this every the, year like, it gets
cool
a little harder.
Until I'm in the back of that ambulance, like with the neck brace on. I'm like, coach, you run practice today. Oh, so let's go to the next question. So favorite athlete, who you got?
Yeah, I'm a little off the grid here. I'm a big in terms of. Sports watching. I love watching golf and tennis. Tennis is my favorite sport to watch, and Novak Djokovic is my favorite athlete. And you know, the main reason why he's my favorite is because he wasn't the best for a long time. You know, there was a stretch where Federer and Nadal were just owning every tournament.
Andy Murray came in and stole a Wimbledon at one point. Yeah.
Wawrinka. You know, there was a couple little guys here and there. But, you know, Djokovic was just on the cusp. He was like third, you know, like a solid third. And then, you know, reading some articles about him and doing some research on him, he really ramped up his diet and he ramped up his stretching and mobility, you know, and he said, you know, if I'm going to beat those guys, I have to be in a lot better shape. I have to be a lot more bouncy, a lot more stretchy, be able to get to balls that some guys can't get to. So, you know, a lot of what I've read about him is about perseverance and getting knocked down, quite honestly, and how are you going to get up and respond. So I've really taken a liking to the type of athlete that he is and how well he moves and the time and effort that he's put in, not only to getting better at the sport, but his diet, his overall
makeup. Yeah, yeah, his dedication. He, I mean, he'd probably be, you know, a receiver or maybe like a like a three or a four in basketball. He's so long.
If he could shoot, I mean, he could probably play point guard because he's quick. He could shoot. He can handle the ball probably. So, yeah, I mean, he's very, very talented. He's fun to watch too because he gets the balls.
Well, the Wimbledon, this past Wimbledon final was crazy. I was actually rooting for Federer.
Probably one of the best.
I love Federer.
Best matches ever.
Oh, it was great.
It was as good as
great
I've ever seen.
Except for that Nadal-Federer Wimbledon final like 5 years ago, I think it was. But, no, I'm with you on that. Okay. Pre-game routine. So basketball, football, whatever, whichever you want to talk about, you want to talk about both. What's your pre-game routine as a coach? You know, obviously your guys are doing their thing. Do you have something that you do specifically or no?
Basketball, I didn't. Basketball, there were so many games, right? I mean, there was no pregame routine that I followed through with for basketball. But football, it's only once a week, right? So pregame routine, very simple. We always eat as a team before the game. And then after we eat, I always meet with the team, just myself, without the other coaches. The other coaches have other responsibilities and other things to do. So I meet with the team probably about three hours before the game or so, 3.5 hours, and just talk a little bit, maybe show them like a YouTube clip of something, you know, some type of motivating action. And then after that, I always like to give the kids and the coaches their own space, right? Because if you played sports your whole life, different people prepare different ways, right? So some people need to listen to music. Some people need to go talk to 80 people. Some people sit in the corner. I had one quarterback who he would take the football and he would just throw it in the air like 2 or 3 feet. And he would walk around the perimeter of the school for like an hour just to get his mind right and focused.
Yeah.
No headphones, no nothing. Just like – so I think that there is a degree of everybody doing their own pregame ritual. So I guess mine would be after we eat and I meet with the team, seeing what other people's pregame rituals are.
Yeah.
So, because by the time the game comes, you're prepared, you're ready.
Yeah.
And we're ready to go.
Yeah. So. Oh, yeah. 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 No, you're right. You know, well, I think that's interesting. Yeah. To give them space and yeah, everybody, it's not a one size fits all thing there. It's, you know, hey, we're here. Like you got to walk around. You know, it's everybody does deal, and you want everybody to be as comfortable as possible going in, you know?
Right, exactly.
Okay, coaching quirk. So something that you would consider, I don't know, quirky about your coaching style or maybe something you say or, you know, anything that someone might be like, oh, that's a little strange.
I don't know about a quirk, but football-wise, on the sidelines, very calm, very, very calm. Like, I've gotten in 10 years as a coach, I've gotten excited a couple times, you know, 5, 6 times. But, I mean, you're talking over 100 games coached now, a handful of times maybe, but usually very calm, very quiet, and usually away from the action. Like, does that make sense? So if the ball mm-hmm. is on the 30-yard line, I'm on, like, the opposite 30 by myself.
Mm-hmm.
Very, like, very quiet to myself. I have the headset, so I'm always talking into the headsets. But, you know, people will sometimes say, like, oh, he's not even focused. He's not even in the game. Look how far away he is from the players and stuff. And, you know, it's really just, like, a kind of a focus that I have personally where I have to get my mind right. I'm thinking, you know, 7-8 plays ahead, thinking series ahead. And as the head coach, you have to manage a game, right? So when we're on – I'm the offensive coordinator, but we're on, when we're on defense is usually the case. I'm thinking about, you know, if we give up a big play here, where do we go? If we get a 3-and-out here, what do we do? You know, if they punt, do we go to block it? Do we send a return? You know, so there's all these things going on, and I just feel like – there's times where I need to be like by myself alone. So it's a little bit of a quirk that you don't really see a lot of coaches do. You know?
It makes sense though, you know, because football is super, you know, basketball is very emotional. Football is very emotional, you know? And, you know, guys, somebody makes a big play on one side of the ball or the other, everybody around you is jumping up and down. I can see how it would be important to kind of be away and detached. And so you're thinking about that next play and you're not getting caught up in that moment. So I do kind of get that. It makes a bunch of sense to me. My players would say I
would say challenge them and try to get the most out of them. You know, I think that it's important as a coach that we're always challenging our kids and trying to get the most out of them no matter what. Even if it means we dig into them a little bit, I think that that's how they grow and build character. And I think down the road, they thank us for it.
You know,
being in the profession for as long as we have, we have kids who have graduated, they're out of college, they have jobs, things like that. And they always come back, right, coach? And they're like, thank you. They kind of, you know, say thank you. So I think I challenge our kids a lot. It's a big piece of it.
I mean, you know, and today sometimes it gets tricky with the sensitivity everywhere. But, I mean, down the line, that's your, you know, even if you don't like your coach or you don't like a teacher, guess what? My always thing, like, you might have a boss that you don't like. Like, how are you going to do now? If you're in a situation later on, you have a family, like, you might have to deal with that. And so, you know, figure it out and kind of deal with adversity. But, I think that's a – I think most good coaches are going to challenge their guys. After a big win, your victory meal is what? What do you got? Like, I mean, we all got our thing. We all got our stops along the way. I'm a pizza guy. You know, that's my thing. If I get a piece, if I get some pizza, I'm in good shape. So what do you got?
Yeah, usually for me it's wings. I love wings.
Yeah, I'm a can't go wrong with
big it. Sucker for wings.
Yeah.
So
can't go wrong with a wing. Yeah, no, it's honestly that's one of my favorites as well. Okay, so this one I didn't give you this question ahead of time, but you mentioned a book before that you liked. How about a favorite sports book or sports movie? One or the two that you really really connect with or really resonates with you?
My favorite is both. Moneyball.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah. So, and the reason why I love Moneyball, the movie and the book, the book is a little bit more detailed.
Yeah.
You know, with regard to some of the players
and
what they do and how they do it. But I really like that because at Allentown, you know, we don't have the resources that some other schools have. We have 3 paid assistant coaches for 3 levels in football.
Mm-hmm.
Other schools have 7, 8, you know, they have unbelievable facilities, turf, you name it, you know, and we just didn't have that. So rather than complain about it, you kind of sit there and you say what Billy Beane said, right? It's an uneven game. It's an uneven playing field. How are we going to even the field?
Mm-hmm.
Right. So they get into talking about analytics and they get into like, what can we do to beat the Yankees? And I'm a Yankee fan, so it was even funnier to watch, from the other perspective. As a Yankee fan, we're like, why don't we just sign everybody? We have billions, you know, type of thing. But, you know, the Oakland A's, they, you know, the way that Billy Beane constructed the team, the way that he utilized strategy and analytics and statistics and different information to put together what he did was fascinating to me. So I always think about that as a coach rather than say, oh, well, you know, we have this, but this team has way more than us. You know, we can't compete. You say it's an uneven field, but who cares? What do we have to do to get there? So I thought that that was a great book and movie to relate to.
Yeah. Well, and the thing about Billy Beane that's interesting is, you know, as a Met fan, he was the guy in our farm organization, you know, our farm system. You know, he didn't pan out, you know, but he, when he walked in a room, he was the five tool guys, tall, strong, you know, and through his failure as a player, that's kind of the interesting thing is he turned that around and he was able to, you know, channel that into becoming prop. You could make an argument. Well, a couple of things. One, he executed the idea, but he was also willing to listen to younger guys and what they had to say and what they saw. So I think there's a lot of elements to Billy Beane, but ultimately it was Billy's job, you know, hey, okay, I can listen to this kid and this might sound good on paper, but he went all in on it. And an interesting book. Then you look at other sports and everybody has followed his lead since that
point. Right. He was like the pioneer, right?
Yeah, right.
So, you know, an interesting part.
I think Bill James, they probably say the guy, the baseball guy who had the baseball prospectus or whatever. But again, he was never, I don't know what his normal job was, but he was like the guy who started thinking about those stats. But again, Billy is the one who executed it at a pro level. So.
Right. And, you know, you never know how much truth there is sometimes to when it gets put into a movie or a book or something.
Right.
But just the scene where you have kind of the older scouts around.
Right.
And he's like, look, we can't think like the Yankees because we don't have the money the Yankees do. You know, he started really diving into what it took to create a competitive advantage at a disadvantage. You know, So I was fascinated by that. I watch it often. I still love the movie. And
yeah, it's a rewatchable. You can, if whatever point of the movie it's on, you could just, yeah, okay. He's picking his daughter up at the airport or dropping her off or it's the game against the Yankees or during the winning streak. Yeah, it's just it's a great movie. Good acting. Yeah, I'm with you. Well, Coach, I think this was a great episode. I think whoever listens to this is gonna get better as a coach from this conversation, particularly from your experiences. And I appreciate you taking the time. You know, it's been great. So Garden State Coach Cast, over and out. Again, Coach Jay Graber from Mattawan. Really excited to see what you guys do this season. And, that's all she wrote.
Thanks, man. Thanks for having me.
Yeah.